Head on down to Boston to welcome into the program our friend, writer and critic, Colin Fleming. Colin, good afternoon.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing very well, thanks. How are you today?
Oh, pretty well.
How many trips up and down the monument today?
You know, I've let the side down. I haven't done any since my 8 climbs on whatever day that was, Sunday, I think. So I'm actually a little bit sore, and it was pretty humid, and 8's 8, so I decided to take a couple days off.
Oh, good. You've earned the rest. No question about that. You've also been busy doing a lot of writing. I was reading on the social media. You've had some of your, and you're already incredibly productive, and you've been doing even a heavy lifting for you of late.
I have, yeah. I've gone off on a bit of a run. I did a couple essays, and they totaled about 3,500 words, a couple of reviews, and then I did 2 full short stories that came out to around 10,000 words, and that was all within about a 10-day period, and most of my life is given over to trying to get money and get people who despise me to respond to me after ignoring me for years, but cranked out about 14,000 words pretty quickly there.
Well, let's talk about a couple of recent pieces you've published on the Beatles, and let's start with what you wrote about at Rolling Stone, rollingstone.com, and a fascinating time in the Beatles' career when they were already pretty big in Britain but had not hit the scene yet here in America, and it's the 1963 Pop Goes the Beatles series on BBC.
Right. They were going to Maida Vale Studios, and they were basically acting as human jukeboxes. They would field requests from people. People would write in on postcards with little pictures of their beloved mock tops, and they would joke around with the host. They would take the piss, as it were, and they would play a number of songs that they just wouldn't visit, really, on vinyl during their career. And so they had this one session on June 2nd, 1963, that was one of the high water marks for me of everything the Beatles ever achieved. And it's really quite an interesting couple of days, because the day before, they are over at EMI, and they are only knocking out a little song called She Loves You, which I think is their first mature masterpiece and one of their 4 or 5 best songs. When you listen to that song, it's really striking how wise it is. It's written in this kind of second-person directive-based style, and it has this amazing energy. And energy isn't just like, let's play fast, let's be up-tempo. Energy is something that I think informs every single great work of art there has ever been. It will always have energy. And they took that energy into the next day, and they basically said, you know what, let's take on our heroes. Let's show the people out there that the people who came before us, Elvis, Chuck Berry, and Carl Perkins, cannot touch what we can do with their material and with our own new material.
Well, and they started by setting the bar high, the holy grail for Elvis aficionados, taking on his version of That's All Right, Mama.
Right. They did something. If you watch the documentary film, I still think it's the best documentary on the Beatles, called The Complete Beatles, from 1982. There's an interview at the beginning of it with Jerry Marsden of Jerry and the Pacemakers. And he basically performs this Lonnie Donegan number, the skiffle guy. And he does the skiffle version of it, and he says, what we did in Liverpool was we would rock this kind of stuff up. We would take what he calls acky-dacky music, and we would rock it up. Well, Elvis is already pretty rocked up to begin with in 1954 when he's doing That's All Right, Mama. But the Beatles rock it up even more. They imbue this song with this rhythm and blues backbeat. Keep in mind that Elvis song did not have a drummer on it, right? It's just the trio at
right.
the time. And they sort of overlay this backbeat. You can't underestimate. It sounds simple, like, oh, it's the beat. It's on the 2 and it's on the 4. Beat that the Beatles had in their name is just gigantic, and is sort of this countrified, beaty rhythm and blues stomp through this number with the Paul McCartney vocal and these wonderful, like, textured, countrified George Harrison lines. And it's just like, okay, well, I guess we're here to have an old-fashioned cutting contest, basically.
And they went on to play a little Chuck Berry, Arthur Alexander, and what kind of a message did this send to the record-buying public and the listeners of BBC in the summer of 1963?
I don't think it would have really sent anything message-wise to them. They were getting to hear this group that was becoming sort of this country-based phenomenon. And like you said earlier, they weren't really close to breaking in the States yet. Within the Beatles' chronology, they had a different kind of relationship with time. I mean, that's coming in February, which seems pretty close. But when we're talking about the things that a great artist is doing within a two-day period, within a 10-day period, within a week, that kind of thing, you really have to almost go hour by hour. So if you're a British schoolboy and you're taping this off the radio, you probably have already had your mind blown by these people. But you're not really parsing it out where you're saying, like, oh, okay, they're taking on, like, the blackest rhythm and blues in Arthur Alexander. They're going after kind of this rockabilly with Elvis. They're taking on Carl Perkins, who was, like, extra rockabilly beyond Elvis. They're doing Chuck Berry. They're doing their own version of There's a Place, which doesn't get many live airings. They're doing Clarabella by the Jaw to Mars, like this Bill Haley kind of, like, backup band. And you get to hear Lennon wailing away on harmonica, which you hardly ever get in terms of live recordings. You're not going to be thinking like, oh, they're showing they can dominate you every which way you want to play the game. But when we look back on it later and we add a little perception, a little clarity of thought, we can say, yeah, they are beating the bag out of their heroes.
Well, and those were the kind of things they'd been doing and playing, you know, the Cavern Club, the clubs of Liverpool and Hamburg. They've been doing those cover songs for years.
They had been, right. But it's like something like Soldier of Love. I think you could make a pretty good case that Soldier of Love is the best cover they ever did. And we are talking some of the best covers in the history of rock and roll in terms of Twist and Shout and Money. And I almost wonder now if it would be considered like cultural appropriation, because Arthur Alexander was just viewed as the blackest music basically there had ever been in terms of pop music. And they are, I don't want to say they're out-blacking him, but they're out-souling him, which was very strange because it's almost like when we got soccer over here in, like, this country and we started to, like, become competitive with the World Cup. It's not really our thing, right? And the U.S. doesn't make the World Cup in the last go-round, and it's, like, going to catch on eventually, but it's, like, it's not our thing. Like hockey, right? Remember when hockey was, like, not really a huge thing here, and it was surprising when there was, like, Bobby Carpenter, right, getting 50 goals in the NHL. Rock and roll was not England's thing. This is just a few years in. They just have been doing the skiffle, and these guys are doing this kind of crazy rock and roll, and they are pulling from so many more influences with the Broadway show tunes and the rhythm and blues, and other groups usually just pick kind of like one go-to sound, whether it's Chuck Berry, whether it's the blues like the Stones. But the Beatles, they were doing this weird, different kind of amalgamation, and this is the best one-session air-shot version of that.
And a fantastic vocal by Lennon, as you write about on Soldier of Love.
It is, his vocal, but like, let's not forget, too, the backing vocals. Now, no one ever gets into this. I'm doing a book on the Beatles called Same Band You've Never Known, An Alternative Musical History of the Beatles, because I think people just focus on the Hey Judes and the Sgt. Peppers, and that doesn't really tell their musical story. Their musical story is more endemic in something like the backing vocals of Soldier of Love, because that is straight out of girl group pop. And no other British band was doing girl group pop. It would have been seen as effeminate, almost. But they had no compunction with that whatsoever, and it always sounds soulful. So you would oftentimes get these harmony vocals from McCartney when Lennon's singing lead, and you couldn't even really tell often who was doing the harmony and who was doing the lead. But this is just straight up Lennon doing the lead and this wonderful Harrison and McCartney backing vocal, and it coalesces into this groove where you could have been like Slim Harpo's backing band. You could have been as bluesy as it came in this country, in the South, and you would have been like, these white guys that transcends color, they can do their thing.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. That piece in Rolling Stone, rollingstone.com. I loved what you wrote in Salon about the restorative melancholia of Yellow Submarine, being has been released in theaters here 50 years later in limited theaters this summer. And as you point out, this is a project that the Beatles not only weren't really involved in, but maybe didn't think would be successful either.
No, they thought it was ridiculous. They thought it was going to be basically like the Flintstones, except with Liverpudlian singing group in it. And they did come later in life to appreciate it. And I think it was like Lennon was watching it late one night. And he's like, hey, this is pretty good. It's kind of witty. It has his sense of humor. But what I've always really liked about it, and I think it's understated in terms of what the Beatles did, and what the Beatles also had this spirit too, where you'll find these works, and Yellow Submarine is one of them. And it's something I get into in this book I'm doing, where they had nothing to do with the work, but their spirit managed to sort of pervade the work. You see it with that complete Beatles documentary. You see it with the tell-all biography, which I still think is the best one, even though it's kind of trashy, The Love You Make. And we have it here with this film where it starts off right away. It's like Ringo Starr, the cartoon version, he has the blues. And I just love how axiomatic the film lets sadness be. That whole notion of letting something be. I have a friend, like, with the things that I'm sometimes dealing with, he'll just say, like, look, this is awful. I would never wish this upon anyone. Just let it be what it is right now and do what you're doing. And eventually, things are going to sort themselves out in the large-scale way you want them to. And I see that, like, with Yellow Submarine. It just lets things be. It's okay to be blue-hued. You can be bluish and not be a blue meanie, as it were, and go about your life. And I think that's sort of how the film starts.
And even the blue meanies, as you point out, are the perfect villains for this story because they don't like their jobs.
Yeah, the blue meanies are awesome because they have, like, yeah, they want to destroy love and everything. But you know what? Love hardly ever even exists. It's difficult to find. So the blue meanies at least have this moral code, which I really enjoy. Like, I enjoy a villain who, like, doesn't think they're a villain because they think they're doing right and they, like, maintain this sort of parameter, these codes they have. So, like, one of the blue meanies says the blue meanie asked another one a question, and the answer of the question he answers in the affirmative. And the blue meanie who's doing the querying, he freaks out, even though he wants an accurate answer. He says, we meanies will never say yes, we only take no for an answer. And it's like, this is awesome. These dudes are really, really weird. But, like, they're that consistent with their code. Like, you see that same kind of humor in something like Whisnail and I. Like, these two out-of-work actors in London, right, in the 60s. But they have this code, this verbal-based code. And you get that with the meanies. You get that, too, with sort of Jeremy, who's quite literally, his species, he's a boob. But he's also a polymath. He's the smartest person intellectually, person boob, in the entire film. And it's just this wonderful kind of zany weirdness.
And that's the beauty of it, too, is that it allows you, I don't want to say wallow in the melancholia, but there's nothing wrong with going there sometimes. And as we've talked about before, you can't appreciate those moments of happiness if you're always pretending to be happy or giving that public front that says you're happy.
One of the best scenes in A Hard Day's Night, and I wouldn't be surprised if the makers of Yellow Submarine saw that scene and thought, you know what, we can do something with this in cartoon form, which is not a point I've ever seen anyone make, is when Ringo Starr, actual Ringo Starr, is hungover for that sequence near the end of A Hard Day's Night, where he's walking on the side of, like, this, it's not even a river, right? It's not even like this sluice. It's kind of like this dirty industrial sort of canal that just is leaching the goodness out of the earth. And he's stomping about in the mud, and he meets a kid who's up to truancy, and, like, his little friends are down below, and Star is hungover, and he's just walking around, and they're filming this, and it's like, yeah, this is kind of, I like this pace. This melancholia is kind of, I don't know, it's regenerating almost. Like, your energy is going to follow from this fallow period after. And that's sort of how Yellow Submarine works. It goes sort of very down tempo in the beginning. The colors are a little closer to a black and white, and this full-throated shout of Vermilion and all of that. And it just sets this mood where it's like, look, you know what? I don't have to be like, a lot of shows, I feel like they almost try to shame you by saying you are not part of this group. You want in, but you don't have in, whether that's The Sopranos or whatever. Like, you're not in this group. And Yellow Submarine, the film, it doesn't do that. It's just like, you know what, maybe you're not feeling great today. This is, you know, come with us. It'll be cool. It'll work out the way you want it to work out.
Check out Colin's pieces, the recent ones in Salon and Rolling Stone on the Beatles. And the best thing to do is go to Colin's website, colinflemminglit.com, and you can check out all of his Beatle writings there and everything else that he's been working on of late. Great stuff, as always. Colin, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week.
Sounds good.